From The Nation magazine, this is Start Making Sense. I'm John Wiener. Later in the hour, John Nichols will have our protest update for the week. Topics include Tesla dealer showroom picketing, national park protesting, Ukraine support marching, and town hall yelling. But first, the Supreme Court has taken up its first case challenging one of Trump's executive orders. Rob Weissman of Public Citizen will explain in a minute.
Hey guys, Mark Wahlberg here. You've heard me say it before, but I'm going to say it again. You guys have to check out Hallow. This Lent, we are doing something really powerful. It's a 40-day prayer challenge for every day of Lent with Jonathan Rumi, Father Mike Schmitz, and of course, yours truly. We are going through the incredible book, The Way by St. Jose Maria Escriva, and I, along with my buddy Chris Pratt, will lead us through weekly fasting challenges. Join me and millions of others around the world praying every day this Lent. Stay prayed up and God bless you.
When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.
The Supreme Court ruled on the first legal challenge to one of Trump's executive orders on Wednesday morning, and it's a major defeat for Trump. The issue was Trump's day one executive order declaring what he called a pause of foreign aid, $2 billion for the U.S. Agency for International Development that had been appropriated by Congress. The case challenging that was brought by, among others, the nonprofit group Public Citizen. Their co-president, Robert Weissman, joins us now. Rob, welcome back and congratulations on this victory at the Supreme Court. It's a big one.
Yeah, thank you very much. It is a big deal and hopefully the first of many.
Well, this was the first Supreme Court test of Trump's effort to take complete control of the federal government, slash its workforce and spending. But let's look at the specifics of this case. What did Trump try to do with U.S. AID and its funding?
Well, this is not about the agency itself, but it's about the grants that the USAID makes and the State Department makes. So foreign assistance grants to contractors around the world who provide healthcare to medicine to people who are sick, provide food to people who are hungry, assistance to women and girls who are trafficked and abused, invest in environmental protection, development programs, and so on. And Trump came in and said, okay, we're putting a pause on all those grants, even though those grants are being put forward through duly enacted contracts, spending money that Congress has appropriated for that purpose.
And you went to court and the courts agreed with you that the executive branch has an obligation to faithfully execute the laws passed by Congress. The Trump administration appealed that restraining order, restraining them from withholding the funds, to the Supreme Court, which they have a right to do. Obama appealed to the Supreme Court issues where he had been challenged by lower courts. So did Biden. What did the Supreme Court say in their decision Wednesday morning?
Well, actually, what happened is that the lower court issued a temporary restraining order and said, look, while we're considering the underlying issue, let the money start flowing again, because based on an original look at the case, we think the plaintiffs, our clients, are likely to win. The Trump administration didn't do it. Then the court issued an order saying comply with our order, and the Trump administration didn't do it. And then the court did another one and they didn't do it. In fact, the evidence is they did nothing to release a dollar over a course of almost 2 weeks. Finally, the court was fed up and said, okay, now you've got 36 hours and we mean it this time. Then the Trump administration appealed first to the appellate court, which said, we don't have jurisdiction. Then the Supreme Court, which said, we'll listen to the case, or at least we'll take the case based on written submissions. And today the Supreme Court on a 5-4 decision has said, Trump administration, you have to follow the order from the lower court judge. So in one way, it should be completely non-controversial that the administration has to follow orders issued by the judiciary. But also simultaneously, it's a giant deal because this administration is of the view that it doesn't have to follow the law. And the Supreme Court, at least for now, has said, yes, you do.
So, as you said, the vote was 5-4, with John Roberts and Amy Comey Barrett joining the liberals, and a written dissent by Samuel Alito, who asked, quote, "Does a single district court judge have the unchecked power to compel the government of the United States to pay out and probably lose forever $2 billion taxpayer dollars?" What's your answer to Justice Alito?
Well, the answer is yes, he does. But the more substantive answer is that that's an unreasonable framing. It was the government's framing. But what happened is the U.S. government is involved in contracts with agencies and contractors around the world to provide the services that I referenced to advance humanitarian purposes. The administration comes in and says, we're not paying the contracts. The judge said, well, I think you're probably going to be required when this case is over to pay those contracts. In the meantime, start the money flowing. And if you win, then you can stop paying. But for now, start paying. It's not an order to suddenly pay $2 billion that they weren't that the government hadn't already obligated itself to pay. It's just saying your intervention to stop the payments that otherwise would have been made is illegal and cannot stand. So Justice Alito's framing is misplaced and doesn't really characterize what's going on in this case at all.
So, although the Supreme Court took this case, it wasn't really about a constitutional issue. In fact, Trump's lawyers made it clear in their court papers they were not challenging the underlying issue here of the separation of powers, the Congress appropriates funds and the president faithfully executes the laws and the courts are empowered to review those actions. Trump's lawyers did not argue he had the power to defy Congress or defy the courts. So, exactly what was this decision about?
Well, it is true in a way that, as I said, it's really just about an enforcement order on a temporary restraining order that had not been challenged, that the government accepted it was legitimately issued. So in that way, it's very specific and really should be non-controversial. And in view of what's actually going on in the world and with what the administration actually is, it raises exactly the questions that you were raising. Can the Trump administration refuse to follow a judicial order? Can the Trump administration completely undermine, ignore, circumvent, and basically trash the congressional power of appropriations? And the Supreme Court today, at least, to both those questions said, no, you have to follow the orders and you can't trash the separation of powers. Congress appropriates money, you've got to spend it the way Congress said to do it.
You know, some of our more skeptical friends think Trump and the Musk people will simply defy the court and continue doing what they did before and just not disperse any of the money. But I just want to underline here, that's not what Trump's lawyers told the court. In fact, they said the opposite. In their appeal, they said the administration, quote, takes seriously its constitutional duty to comply with the orders of federal courts. The government is undertaking substantial efforts to review payment requests and release payments, close quote. So it seems like they were challenging only the deadline they were given by the court. Have I got that right?
Well, we shouldn't really presume good faith on the side of the Trump administration. So that's sort of right and sort of not. I think what we really won today was an important legal victory. Practically, as it involves getting money to the grantees, it's a little more murky. It's also the case that this administration is playing that if they lose in court, they're going to try to find a way to do the thing they were just told not to do, claiming some other authority. So I think we're going to win this case. The freeze is going to be found to be illegal and unconstitutional, and the money's going to have to flow, except that the government has already said it plans on canceling and thinks it already has canceled about 90% of the grants it has through the U.S. Agency for International Development and maybe something like two-thirds of the grants through the Department of State. So as regards the humanitarian nightmare that's being forced by this, and it's fair to say probably tens of thousands of lives have already been lost from these canceled grants, we're not out of the woods on that at all. But in terms of the legal issue at the Supreme Court, we won something important. And the counter scenario would have been a disaster. If it's the case that the Supreme Court had ruled the Trump administration is free to refuse judicial orders, to just not acknowledge them or follow them, then we would have really been speeding into a state of lawlessness, worse than what we otherwise face.
So just hypothetically here, if the administration fails to disperse the money now, according to the court schedule, what happens then? What will you do?
Well, I think they're going to, but they're gonna probably fight over exactly what it means to disperse the money, including to they're gonna say they shouldn't disperse it to grantees they've canceled. So we're gonna have to deal with that. But if they out and out refuse, then we'll move again as we did earlier for contempt of court on the officials who were responsible for this.
One other question. Didn't they fire everybody at USAID? Is there anybody left at the agency to actually disperse the money?
It's a huge practical problem. So there are a number of grantees in the last day or two who've received notices saying your freeze is over, resume your work. But there's no human being for them to talk to, the people they were engaged with before, to get the funding flowing to enable them to resume the work. So yeah, that's a real serious practical problem. And it's a disaster in this case. As I said, like, people's lives are being lost as a result of this. And it speaks to this broader problem we're going to face throughout this administration, that their complete willingness to obliterate federal agencies, their readiness to ignore or circumvent the law, combines to mean that even when we win cases, they're not going to be clean victories. We're going to still have to push and push and push again, and it's going to be unsatisfactory, even in the winning circumstances, many times.
And we do have a reminder of what is at stake with the funding in this case. There was a memo from a man named Nicholas Enrich, acting assistant administrator for global health at USAID. He released a series of memos, I think last weekend, that he had prepared about the effects of the Trump cuts to humanitarian assistance. Let me just read some of the highlights. You've kind of referred to them briefly in passing. If the money is not restored promptly, more than 16 million pregnant women and more than 11 million newborns would not get medical care. 200,000 children would be paralyzed with polio. 1 million children will not be treated for severe acute malnutrition. 12 million new cases of malaria this year, 30% increase in TB, 775 million cases of avian flu. I could go on. He did go on. And of course, he was fired right after releasing that memo. You're saying some of this damage is already beginning. If the funding is restored, it will have life-saving benefits for millions of people. But you're saying we can't be sure at this, today anyway, that this is actually going to happen.
I think the money is going to start flowing, and I think it'll probably start flowing, a little imperfectly. And also, the administration has said, from their point of view, they've already canceled the vast majority of these grants. So what they did with the freeze, it was a blanket thing. They said, we're putting everything on pause while we review the grants. Now they claim to have reviewed the grants, an implausible claim given that there's thousands of them, that they've reviewed the grants and they've canceled the majority of them. So that's going to be the next phase of this fight. And those statistics that you're reading, those are human beings, and it's heartbreaking, and it is utterly pointless. There's no business interest that's advocating for this. There's no religious interest that's advocating for this. There's no national security interest promoting this. It is just destruction for its own sake, and with massive human consequences delivered by people who are oblivious to other humans' needs, well-being, and even lives.
So this was not a Supreme Court ruling about Trump's effort to take complete control of the federal government and slash its workforce and spending. There are many other of Trump's executive orders that challenge the constitutional separation of powers. But do you think that Wednesday's 5-4 vote against Trump at the Supreme Court has implications for other cases dealing with his unconstitutional executive orders?
Yeah, so we're doing pretty well in the courts, in the lower courts so far, in challenging the administration's rampant illegality. We can't keep up, the collective we can't keep up. And there are problems, some of the things that are identifiably illegal don't lend themselves to litigation. But the record in the lower courts is very strong. This case implicates some of the key themes that are underlining all these cases: separation of powers, duty to follow judicial orders. questions about whether the government has to spend money that's congressionally appropriated. So it's a hopeful sign. It's a hopeful sign. We're for sure going to lose some of these cases along the way, but today was a good win.
Rob Weissman, co-president of Public Citizen, which won a huge victory at the Supreme Court on Wednesday morning when the court rejected Trump's efforts to halt foreign aid spending mandated by Congress. Rob, congratulations on this victory, and thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Hey guys, Mark Wahlberg here. You've heard me say it before, but I'm going to say it again. You guys have to check out Hallow. This Lent, we are doing something really powerful. It's a 40-day prayer challenge for every day of Lent with Jonathan Rumi, Father Mike Schmitz, and of course, yours truly. We are going through the incredible book, The Way by St. Jose Maria Escriva, and I, along with my buddy Chris Pratt, will lead us through weekly fasting challenges. Join me and millions of others around the world praying every day this Lent. Stay prayed up, and God bless you.
Hello, my name is Jorge Gaviria, and I'm the founder of Macienda. We partner with farmers in Mexico to bring heirloom corn products to every kitchen. With my Spark Cash Plus card from Capital One, I earn unlimited 2% cash back on every purchase. And it has no preset spending limit, which means my purchasing power adapts to my business needs. My Spark card helps me fulfill my mission of bringing masa to the masses. Capital One, what's in your wallet?
Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus.
Now it's time for this week's protest roundup. The many ways people have marched, picketed, rallied, and generally yelled at Trump and Musk and Republicans. For that, we turn to John Nichols. He's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. John, welcome back.
It's great to be with you, John.
So our task today is to talk about some of the anti-Trump and anti-Musk protests going on just in the last couple of days. My list is Tesla dealer showroom picketing, immigrant rights marching, Bernie Sanders rallying, Ukraine support demonstrating, national park protesting, and town hall yelling. Let's start with Tesla dealer showroom picketing. Under the slogans Tesla takedown and pull the plug on Elon, we've seen protests outside Tesla dealers in lots of places: Tucson, Denver, Boston. San Francisco has been a big center. Honk if you hate Elon is the signs people are carrying in the center of town on Van Ness and O'Farrell. More than 100 people have been gathering there every Saturday. New York City at the Tesla showroom downtown on the far west side, Washington Street at the corner of West 13th, were news reports of noisy, peaceful, nonviolent action organized by Rise and Resist. What do you think? It's kind of a unusual form of political protest, picketing car dealerships.
You know, look, this is a way to get a message to Elon Musk and to the Trump administration about the horrific cuts and the kind of disastrous approach that they've adopted toward the federal government and toward federal workers. And it's proven to be incredibly successful, maybe because it's an easy thing to target. In Tucson, they had in the range of 1,300 to 1,500 people out on Saturday. In Denver, they had about 1,000. It looks like roughly 1,000 or more in New York. But even in smaller communities across the country, we're seeing 300, 400, 500 people show up. When you add this all up, just the Tesla targeting, what you see is something that is very akin to the nascent early Tea Party movement of 2009, 2010 against Barack Obama. These are people who are coming out without a lot of organizing, without a lot of structure, and saying, you know, we want to send this message. So it's a big deal, and I think it'll be bigger this coming weekend.
One more thing. Tesla stock as of today is down more than 25% for the year. This has wiped out, I don't know, $600 billion in market value since December. This has cost Elon Musk something like $140 billion of his net worth. You think he notices a $140 billion drop?
Oh, I think the billionaire class, who I've written a lot about, they notice every penny. That's the weird part about it. It's never enough, right? They always want more. And if they lose something, it bugs them.
I want to talk also about the Ukraine support rallies in Chicago and Vermont, elsewhere. since Trump staged that media event where he humiliated Zelensky. In Boston, hundreds, thousands of demonstrators carried signs saying, "We stand with Ukraine," in blue and yellow, the colors of the flag of Ukraine. The most notable was in Vermont, where J.D. Vance planned a ski vacation with his family. But on the roads from the airport to the ski slopes, he was greeted by more than 1,000 protesters lining the street of his route. Signs reading, "Go ski in Russia." That protest seems to have been organized by the Indivisible group up there, Mad River Valley. Certainly made for some great TV footage.
Yeah, you know, the thing about Elon, or about J.D. Vance, I'm sorry to confuse the actual vice president with the sometimes shadow president.
Yes.
But the thing about J.D. Vance is he's supposed to be a pretty smart guy. But, you know, I'm not sure what the logic of going to ski in Vermont was. You're actually going to one of the most liberal states in the country by any measure. And it is, I can't repeat some of what was written on some of the signs on a family podcast. But what I can tell you is that they had a lot of fun mocking him, and they had a lot of fun, you know, focusing on him. They would have protested anyway, I think, but I think the crowds were larger, and I think the crowds were more impassioned, frankly, because this is one of the first opportunities to push back on what you saw in the Oval Office or in the White House when Zelensky came to visit. Because it's pretty clear that in that meeting, if you watch the whole 50 minutes of it, that Vance was the driving force there. He was the one trying to upend this deal.
We haven't seen hardly anything of J.D. Vance. It's all been Musk in the news. This was his kind of reemergence as, you know, a part of the Trump administration.
What was striking was that Trump actually sat back through a lot of it, and Vance kept driving it. I think that suddenly we've got a triumvirate of people that folks want to protest against now. They initially, it was Trump and Musk. And I think Vance has succeeded in putting himself into that space and having a lot of people who are frankly very upset with him.
He's sort of a little bit like Elon Musk in that nobody really likes J.D. Vance. He doesn't really have a base.
Yeah, and not to relitigate the 2024 presidential campaign, but I know that Andy Beshear of Kentucky really wanted to be the vice presidential nominee because he had this whole theory of going after J.D. Vance and how successful it could be of saying, you know, look, I'm the governor of a state that actually has Appalachia in it, yeah. Not, you know, a guy who came and vacationed in Appalachia and then wrote a kind of nasty book about it. Yeah. And so I agree with you that Vance is not a beloved figure. I think Trump likes that. I think Trump likes it when he's not the least popular guy in the room. And Vance really, you know, he's had a bad couple weeks because if you'll note, his visit to the security conference in Munich didn't exactly go well. There's actually thinking that what Vance came and did, where he like reached out to the AfD, the far right party in Germany, actually harmed the AfD vote.
Yeah, they didn't do as well as was expected, I know.
So it's like Vance is sort of a universal global downer.
Great. Well, I also want to talk about the national park support rallies. Thousands of people protested last weekend at national parks everywhere, basically, to protest the Trump administration firing at least 1,000 National Park Service employees last month. Organizers here seem to be a group called Resistance Rangers, off-duty yep. park rangers, some of whom had been fired. There were protests at least 145 sites. Other people say 400 sites at, you know, the famous places, Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, Yellowstone. A lot of the national park protests were in red states, in Montana, at Glacier National Park, in Wyoming, at Yellowstone, in Utah, at Arches National Park, Indiana Dunes National Park. In Kentucky, the protests at Mammoth Cave National Park, where my family went for a vacation when I was a kid, one protester said, quote, "The parks are not political. The parks are for everybody. They belong to everybody. They are meant to be enjoyed by future generations," close quote. And that's coming from Kentucky.
Going after the national parks, it may have been one of the dumber things that they did. I have always said that the most popular, you know, kind of public employees is postal workers, right? Yeah. And I think people love postal workers. Yeah. But I am discovering in recent weeks that people love park rangers maybe even more.
Yeah.
And I was at an event in Eastern Iowa. It was one of these Bernie Sanders rallies. And they had a park ranger come up and speak before Sanders did. And it was standing ovation immediately. But beyond that, his presentation was a young park ranger, and it was so poignant because he was clearly not a particularly political guy. He was just saying, I love the outdoors. This job was a dream come true for me. The thing I love the most is introducing young people to the outdoors so that they can be a part of their life. And you know, there were literally people with tears in their eyes as this guy spoke. And so I do think, you know, in a way, what we're looking at here is a fabric of protests, different kinds of protests in different places for different reasons and different focuses. But people understand something here, and that is that there's a need to push back against what Musk especially is doing, but also what Trump and Vance are doing. And they're looking for entry points. One of those entry points is the national parks. It's a labor of love job, and pretty much all they ask of the federal government is, you know, a fair wage and maybe a pension some years down the line. These are not people that anyone sees as taking something from the taxpayer. And so I think they've been very, very effective as one space in which a lot of protest has occurred.
Well, now it's time for your Minnesota moment. News from my hometown of St. Paul that you won't get from Sean Hannity. Just want to review a couple of the protests in the past week in Minnesota. In Duluth on Sunday was the largest gathering yet outside the office of Representative Pete Stauber. He's the Republican who's taken over the House seat in northern Minnesota. Protesters lined the street, waving flags, brandishing signs, demanding that he hold a town meeting. He's one of the people who's refused to hold a town meeting.
A lot of them are, John.
This is the third protest there in less than a month demanding that he hold a town hall. One of the protesters said, we're here because we want to make sure Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security continue to be supported. Pete Stauber made a promise back in 2019 that he would support those, and we want to make sure he's doing that. But now he seems to be catering to Trump and his policy of undermining the democracy of this country. That was in Duluth. In Richfield, suburban Minneapolis, hundreds of demonstrators marched to Richfield City Hall to protest immigration enforcement by ICE in suburban Minneapolis. Apparently there was an ICE raid in St. Louis Park, another suburb west of Minneapolis, where ICE detained a total of seven people that they found at a factory. In Red Wing, Minnesota, on the Mississippi River south of St. Paul, high school students protested restrictions on DEI and their defense of Black studies. And in Minneapolis on Friday night, several hundred people marched from the Ukrainian American Community Center across the Hennepin Avenue Bridge in support of Ukraine and Zelensky. There's a group, Stand With Ukraine Minnesota. The Ukrainian American Community Center in Minneapolis says there are more than 20,000 Minnesotans of Ukrainian descent. This has been your Minnesota moment, a special feature of this broadcast, but I don't think Minnesota is especially unusual in what's been going on in the last week.
Places like Red Wing are not big left-wing centers. Duluth is, but a pretty moderate place. And so when people are getting out on the streets, that means something is happening. People coming from a lot of different perspectives, but with a clear desire to change the course of what this administration is doing. And it's happening very early in the administration. And that's significant because I think a lot of the Republicans in Congress are being kind of almost blindsided by this. They're around Washington. They think Trump is very popular. They've bought into this fantasy. Some of them just fear Musk's money. If they go awry, they'll face a primary challenge. But many of them, I think, were really bought in. And then they've gone back to their districts, often very gerrymandered districts, and run into crowds of very angry people. Why is that? Because I think maybe Democrats and progressives made a mistake along the way. They didn't talk as much about what the federal government does for people. And suddenly as Musk has attacked it all, folks are waking up and saying, look, I want scientific research to, tackle Alzheimer's and to go after glaucoma and all these other issues. I want universities to be funded. I want health research. I want Medicare, Medicaid. I want Social Security. I want, all of these things that the federal government has a hand in. Now, that doesn't mean people don't want the government to be more efficient, and some of them probably are pretty conservative. But the notion that you would just lop it all off and just start to destroy it, right down to the national parks, that is generating a movement. And that movement, I think, is ultimately going to be quite comparable to the Tea Party movement of 2009, 2010. The Tea Party movement had a lot of fake elements to it. It was pushed by a lot of corporations. I think this is a lot more genuine, but it's still this core concept that a movement develops that all initially forces a political party. The Tea Party movement is the Republicans, this movement, it's the Democrats, to be much stronger in its opposition, but that ultimately transforms into an electoral force. And I think that what we're seeing across the country will have repercussions for Trump and the Republicans in this year's off-year elections and next year's midterm elections.
One last thing. Some of our friends say none of these protests are going to change Trump. So why are we doing them? What's your answer to those people?
I think there's no question that they could change Trump. I don't think for a second that if you know the history of Donald Trump, you imagine that he can't be changed, right? Or that he can't shift. In his first administration, I wrote a book called Horsemen of the Trumpocalypse. It was about all the people in his cabinet and all of his assistants and aides. And the problem for the book was after a year, he had fired just about everybody. And so, yes, I think he can be moved. And I actually think that the place where the biggest movement may already be occurring is in some of the places where he had his greatest strength. Farmers are very upset about tariffs. Older folks are very upset about threats to Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. And one of Trump's great successes was the inroads that he made with young men. And yet we're now seeing a situation where polling and other data suggests that some of these younger folks who are at least open to Trump as a way of kind of disrupting things are becoming very, very concerned about whether they're ever going to have a job, especially a job in something that they might want to work in. Some of them might even want to be park rangers. And so at the end of the day, I think these protests are in the great American tradition, our right to assemble and petition for the redress of grievances. Working in exactly the way they should. And as I go out and cover them and see people at them, what's powerfully striking to me is I don't see many sad faces at protests. Folks seem to be energized. They seem to be hopeful. They seem to believe that it's worth it. And remember where you and I come from, Wisconsin and Minnesota, these are cold places. And so people are willing to go out on a very cold day and protest, sometimes with a lousy sound system or whatever, that suggests to me that there's a vibrant opposition to what Donald Trump is doing. And it's nascent, it's still developing, it's still taking form. But as it begins to link up, and people who go to a Tesla rally one day go to a national park rally the next, you have the potential for a dissenting movement in this country that I think can actually get the country back.
John Nichols, read him at thenation.com. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Start Making Sense, a podcast from The Nation magazine, recorded in Los Angeles at our Blythe Avenue studios. Renee Reynolds is our associate producer. Alan Minsky is our producer. Ludwig Hurtado is executive producer. Dede Guttenplan is editor of The Nation. Bhaskar Sunkara is president of The Nation. And Katrina Vandenhoevel is publisher and editorial director of The Nation. Our theme music is from Barcelona Afrobeat, licensed by Creative Commons. You can find out more about Start Making Sense at thenation.com. And you can subscribe to Start Making Sense on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Wiener. Thanks for listening.
Hey guys, Mark Wahlberg here. You've heard me say it before, but I'm going to say it again. You guys have to check out Hallow. This Lent, we are doing something really powerful. It's a 40-day prayer challenge for every day of Lent with Jonathan Rumi, Father Mike Schmitz, and of course, yours truly. We are going through the incredible book, The Way by St. Jose Maria Escriva, and I, along with my buddy Chris Pratt, will lead us through weekly fasting challenges. Join me and millions of others around the world praying every day this Lent. Stay prayed up, and God bless you.
When you get the Planet Fitness Black Card, you can bring a friend anytime you work out. And now through March 13th, get your first month free when you join. You heard that right. Conquer the stair climber with your partner in climb. Enjoy a post-workout recovery session in the hydro massage. And do it all again with access to any of our 2,700 convenient locations. So, you coming? Get your first month free and all the perks with the PF Black Card for just $1 down, $24.99 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends March 13th. See club for details.